Chapter 9. Well, Hisham, in 1993, September, there was the very unusual and unique White House signing ceremony with thousands of people. And as you know, that day I was doing the live commentary for Canadian National Television. And you came the next year back to, actually, where were you at that time?
Well, in September 93, I was in Palestine. I arrived like 3 months earlier to start, a Fulbright scholarship.
That's right, and we've talked about that. Then you came back. You were there for the summer in 94. You came back, and we had a long TV interview just a few days after you arrived. And I want to remind you of something you said at the time. You said to me, there are a lot more difficulties than ever before. The psyche of the people has been extremely devastated. Not much has been achieved after 7 years of intifada. If there's an agreement, you told me, if there is a peace process unfolding, why is it that the brutalities of the occupation are increasing rather than decreasing? And as I think back on that period, everybody was euphoric in Washington. The whole atmosphere was, wow, the agreement, never before. Now there's going to be peace, and there was a 5-year process, and there'd be a Palestinian state. But apparently the whole situation immediately looked very different to you Palestinians. They're actually living in the territory.
Well, you know, back then in the summer of 94, Mark, when we met, it was really clear then that objectively speaking, there was an unbelievable Israeli victory, in the sense that Israel has succeeded in creating the image that it was making peace with the Palestinians, and it has marketed, this posture all over the world. The world really went to sleep thinking that, Palestinian-Israeli relations have been fully reconciled, while on the ground, the Israelis have exploited, the situation to further the occupation, to build more settlements, to confiscate more Palestinian lands, to tighten the noose around the neck of the Palestinians even, more effectively than ever before. Very well, I was really skeptical of the process since the Madrid talks started, but I was always hoping that my outlook would prove to be wrong. However, after having lived in Palestine for a whole year, the summer of 93 through the summer of 94, and of course I continued to live there thereafter, I had ample opportunity to witness the extent of suffering and pain among Palestinians in Palestinian society that the occupation has caused. In other words, while, one would have expected that the peace process would have transformed Palestinian life, somewhat at least, unfortunately what happened was exactly the other way around. More curfews, more killing, more imprisonment, all under the rubric of the so-called peace process.
What
Israel was doing, all it was doing, that is, furthering the occupation, the world didn't pay attention at all and didn't think that things were bad. To the contrary, the world was operating on the basis that there was a fledgling peace process.
Well, what I hear you saying is that whereas the Americans and the Israelis, and there were plenty of Europeans and plenty of other governments involved, especially that day on the White House, what I hear you saying is an agreement that was supposed to lead to the fulfillment of two-state solution and an honorable, lasting, expanding peace was in reality from the beginning destroying the idea that there could be a two-state solution, and you people in Palestine knew it all right from the start on the ground, whereas the rest of us were still being bombarded daily with all these messages about how peace was coming, finally there's an agreement, finally there's going to be the two-state solution. The whole thing now looks more like a public relations stunt and setup to allow the Israelis to pursue the policies they have pursued ever since, which are more settlements and making a two-state solution impossible.
I really think this is well said. To think of the whole process, even in retrospect today, the Oslo Agreement, the Declaration of Principles that was signed at the White House, was really meant only to grant the Palestinians a self-rule, status, some sort of an autonomy, and perhaps after the end of the transitional period, to establish some sort of a Palestinian entity, some sort of a Palestinian state, the contours of which, of course, were not fully defined. At any rate, in my view, the DOP, the Declaration of Principles, and the whole fabric of the Oslo, Accords, were really meant first and foremost to delve the severest blow to the two-state solution. Also, to think about the whole thing in retrospect, Mark, look at how the process has handled, how it has dealt with the Palestinian people. It has fragmented Palestinians. It has divided Palestinians between those in the 1967 occupied territories. It completely isolated Palestinians living behind the green line, that is, in the 1948 areas. It absolutely overlooked Palestinians living in the diaspora. And even for Palestinians living in the occupied territories, it has classified them into zones A, B, and C. Well, that fragmentation, in effect, meant disunity. But it didn't only mean political disunity, Mark. It also meant social fragmentation, psychological fragmentation. The Oslo Agreement, I believe, was perhaps the most detrimental political blow to the Palestinian people after the Balfour Declaration.
But Hisham, this couldn't have been done without the imprimatur of Yasser Arafat and the PLO. This was done with their cooperation.
Needless to say, of course, that the Palestinian leadership fell into the trap. Arafat was under the impression that he could achieve something for his own people at a time when the international system was not in his favor. The Soviet Union had collapsed. All of the socialist bloc has disappeared. The Arab state system was weaker than ever before. Arab nationalism was dealt a severe blow, when Iraq was hit in 1991. So, yes, indeed, Arafat felt the pressure and felt that the Palestinians were isolated, and indeed they were isolated, and he wrongly calculated, or miscalculated, I should say, that the Oslo Agreement could deliver. I should say that he himself was ambivalent all throughout the process. In other words, he had second thoughts all along, as we said last time, when he signed, the Cairo Agreement, as you recall, Mark. At the beginning, he stepped aside.
Yes. Hisham, you stole my thunder there. I was going to say, what a moment in history that's been largely forgotten. There you had everybody gathered on the stage in Cairo. The cameras of the world were focused. I think the Secretary of State was there. I think Rabin was there. Arafat was there. I think the Russian foreign minister. I'd have to check myself. But it was such a major ceremony. And I can't think of another time where, as the cameras were rolling, the principal person, Yasser Arafat, is paging through the documents in front of him, puts down his pen, says he won't sign these documents, and marches off stage. It was just an unbelievable moment. Now, what actually happened there from, you've been a political scientist in addition to your Palestinian connections. What happened there? What was that symbolic moment all about?
The maps he discovered in the agreement were not what he agreed upon before and were not to his satisfaction. And he really believed that this was deceitful. This is not exactly what he negotiated over with the Israelis. In other words, there was something mischievous.
And on top of that, in human relations, if you trust the people you're dealing with, you act one way. If you already mistrust them totally and then you see them flagrantly abusing you again, you just decide, I'm not going to be part of this anymore, and off you go.
Well, I think this is also well said. I think what you are saying is absolutely important, Mark, in the sense that Arafat didn't even trust some of the members of his own team. He didn't rely on them to scrutinize through the agreement that was presented to him, for signature, even there at the ceremony when the cameras were rolling. So he wanted to look through it himself. And I think this was out of mistrust of the members of the team, and rightly so.
So
because the ones who have hurt him the most, in my view, who have hurt Arafat the most, are the ones who have ill-advised him all the
So important what you're pointing out, and it brings me back to the first Camp David agreement in 78 with the Egyptians. You know, the year before, I had met with Sadat and played a role in that. And as I watched the Egyptians negotiating, I realized they were so outclassed. They were so outgunned at the negotiation table, just like they were in military affairs and political affairs and economic affairs. Sadat didn't get the right advice. They didn't keep good records. And that's why his minister, the hero of Camp David, and most people will never even have heard his name, was Mohammed Ibrahim Kamel, Sadat's personal friend for 40 years, his foreign minister, the only man Sadat went to after he talked with President Carter and told what he was planning to do, and the only man who had the dignity to say to Sadat, this is unacceptable, it must be clearly in writing, it must be studied, we cannot just accept that a conversation took place that we have no records of, and then he resigned. He was the hero of Camp David, and when I interviewed him years later, he told me that he resigned because he knew this would not lead to peace. It was now going to lead to unending war. He turned out to be right. The heroes of this period in time, again, names that many people reading this book won't recognize, Dr. Haider Abdulshafi, who had been the head of the negotiating team in Madrid and the head of the negotiating team the next 2 years. And when Arafat told him what he was going to do, he said it's unacceptable, and he resigned. And then Edward Said, the great scholar who quite immediately after Oslo started speaking up in very harsh tones about the PLO and even Arafat, who he had personally been so involved with. And you too, you were speaking up whenever you had the chance, and we had that chance in the MER TV programs. You were speaking up as much as you'd always been, I believe, a member of Fatah, and you'd been a young insider in those circles, and you too recognized this is not going to lead to what we're being told it's going to lead to.
No, it really clearly was a travesty, Mark. Oslo was very divisive for Palestinians. Was very detrimental to the idea of the two-state solution, was very obstructive, strategically for a solution for the Palestinian problem, because while some from Norway may have been good and well-intentioned, that requires, more study and, deeper analysis, because it was meant to be by the Israelis, I believe, and, by American policymakers, the outcome was destructive. The prolongation of the conflict, the twisting of the conflict into different, into new forms, and I believe the removal of any prospects for a real solution for the conflict, because the Israelis have used what I call the destructive Oslo era fully to their advantage and benefit to complete more layers of the occupation, those that they were unable to do so more directly.
They started racing to build more settlements. They started, the PLO didn't even get a settlement freeze. They started racing to create the bypass roads. They started racing to cut off Jerusalem. cut the area into the different areas A, B, and C, as you suggested. So in reality, what goes down in history as this major step toward peace in the Middle East, it was from the beginning a big, big nail in the coffin of the two-state solution. And it wasn't Rabin's assassination. Then later in 95 came Rabin's assassination, and the Israelis have twisted that, let's say the liberal progressive Israelis who supported Rabin, they've twisted that moment to say, we were on the right track. This could have led to the peace that we've been calling for and dreaming of. But then Rabin got assassinated, and that's when things went bad. But that's not true. Rabin had made things bad from the beginning. He was no peace hero.
Absolutely. You know, Rabin, of course, was the one who started the whole, cleared the policy of the breaking of the bones of Palestinians, the bones and the limbs of Palestinians. And, of course, he vehemently was involved in the suppression of the first Intifada. And Rabin, of course, was the one who signed the DRP, the Declaration of Principles and the Oslo Agreement. But, Rabin's actions were not satisfactory for the extremist, radical, rightist Israeli, although he was really benefiting Israel, but in another way, they saw his actions to be more peace-leaning, and therefore, Yigal Amir, in November of 95, got very close to Rabin and shot him and killed him.
I remember the day exactly because a friend of mine with a famous name and a famous family, John F. Kennedy, was getting married at St. Matthew's in downtown Washington. And I was there at the wedding, and there were two things that stand out about it. One, because John F. Kennedy is a distant cousin of the Kennedys, some people in the media thought, "Oh my God, it's John F. Kennedy, the son, that's getting married in a stealth wedding at St. Matthew's," and they sent reporters over a few blocks away, only to find out it was a different Kennedy. But it was John. As I went through the receiving line, it was John who said to me, "Mark, what do you think of what's just happened?" I hadn't heard. I was standing waiting, but he'd been talking to everybody, and so. But, that assassination, what you said is correct, but I would embellish it with the following. In order to give this quote-unquote peace process a veneer of legitimacy, in order to keep people thinking, gee, maybe something will come of this, in order to keep Arafat and the PA from walking away from it and saying they'd been sold out, some Israelis had to present things in a way that looked to some people, especially the right-wing Israelis, as if Rabin was really going to push this to a two-state conclusion after all. And there had been a five-year time frame that this had been established. So in order to manipulate the public relations of it, the Israelis around Rabin had to present it in a way that infuriated the right-wing, even though they were really doing what the right wing wanted to be done, which was building more settlements, cutting the Palestinians into pieces, and putting nails in the coffin of the two-state solution. But Rabin paid the price for all the political confusion that was necessary in order to keep everybody...
Absolutely. I mean, so you were at a wedding when the assassination happened. Well, I was sitting... Actually, watching the news in Deheshel, in my family's home, that evening. I would never forget that evening. It was around 11 p.m. And, there was breaking news that Rabin was shot and was wounded. That this is what the news first said. And then, immediately afterwards, they said that he didn't make it. He died. Well, the first thing that went through many people's minds was that Rabin was killed by a Palestinian, signifying, of course, widespread opposition to the Oslo Agreement among Palestinians. But then, gradually, we turned to the Israeli TV, and, an anchor came on television and, you know, announced the death of Rabin, and he was crying, and it was major news, you know, for the Israelis. And gradually, of course, the news, you know, became clearer that it was a student from Bar-Ilan University, Yigal Amir, who killed Rabin, who shot him.
But even the assassination, the Israelis used for propaganda purposes. There he was singing the song. The blood of the peace song, the paper was in his jacket, and blood was on it. And they manipulated the scene that Rabin was the champion of peace, and he's been killed because he was leading. But you and I had already had that long TV program the year before. Each of us had spoken up. Edward Said was spoken up. The peace process was already completely corrupted, and there was no reality to the idea that a two-state solution is going to emerge out of this. It was really an Israeli attempt to beef up the autonomy idea, which they had promoted ever since 1967. They must have had 10 different variants of the autonomy idea, going back to the Alon plan and the village leagues, and I'm sure if we took time, we'd come up with many more.
Actually, the idea of autonomy, you know, it goes back even much, much earlier, you know, to 1923, when Jabotinsky published his famous article, I mean, infamous article, The Iron Wall. But at any rate, certainly correct, Mark. The peace process was ruptured before the assassination of Rabin. But let me tell you, give you a sense of, you know, the reaction that, you know, was felt in Palestinian society. I did not speak to Arafat then, but I do know somebody that night who spoke to Arafat, and I spoke to that person, as a matter of fact. And Arafat's first reaction was that, well, this is serious, and this really means, in a way, the practical, the actual end of the peace process. Arafat further said that today it was Rabin, and next it's going to be me. So I believe that Arafat right there and then realized that that attempt to, you know, bring about some semblance of peace was finished. If he had some reluctance before, as he had, you know, with the signing of the Cairo Agreement, I think that reluctance was fully clarified and crystallized for him with the assassination of Rabin.
But he was trapped into a PA system, and he had nowhere to go. And for
exactly.
years after that, he went to Wai River, he went to Hebron, he went to Taba, he went to Camp David again with Clinton in 2000. Actually, it wasn't him again. It was Sadat who'd been there before. And as I look back on this, what I see is Sadat put his faith in the American president, Carter at the time, who may have been well-meaning, but who couldn't deliver and who sold him out for political reasons. And I'm actually proud of an article I wrote in Worldview. I was associate editor of Worldview when Sadat was killed, and I wrote a piece immediately that said, those that are marching behind his casket in Cairo, those who sold him out, those who promised him they were going to do X, Y, and Z. Carter, who had said there was a settlement freeze as part of the Camp David agreement, it was his friends who sold him out. It was his friends who isolated him. It was his friends responsible for what's happened to him. But nevertheless, Sadat put his faith in the American president, and I think Arafat put his faith in the Israeli prime minister, and thus, when he was killed, he realized his peace partner, as he said, was gone. But it was mistaken faith in the first place, because Arafat really didn't understand what was going on.
Well, you know, the partner of peace in peace phrase, which Arafat reiterated almost on every occasion, I think it was meant, you know, for diplomatic and public consumption. Arafat was a very shrewd politician, but I think he started realizing right there and then that this was the end of it. But you are absolutely correct, on the other hand, that he was locked in a PA, you know, defunct, corrupt system, and of course, Arafat was surrounded by a number of advisors who were interested first and foremost in their own in their own issues, in their own benefits, and I think little in the Palestinian cause in general. Without mixing things up.
Those people are still there.
Regrettably, they are, of course. Yes.
And they're still in the most senior positions, and they're still the VIPs traveling all over the world, and they've still got their hidden bank accounts, and they're still doing the same things they did, but they're more despised now, and they're more isolated now from their own people.
That's definitely true. And this is why, you know, when Arafat was under siege by Sharon later on, you know, during the second Intifada, I did write a piece saying that Arafat was under double siege. I mean, a siege by the Israelis, by Sharon himself, but also a siege by, you know, some of the people around him who made it even impossible for, you know, any reasonable Palestinian to get in to see Arafat. At any rate, so since 1995, with the assassination of Rabin, I think Arafat started to realize. He had a lot of faith and trust, though, in Bill Clinton, and I think he visited the White House more than any other, you know.
Oh, yes, how important to remember that. He was the most frequent White House visitor. And you're right, Clinton seduced him, and Clinton promised him X and Y, and Dennis Ross was still there, like he's still in the White House now with Obama, and they pushed Arafat to agree to another terrible agreement, this one in Hebron.
Absolutely.
Where were you when that one took place? This was 97, I think.
I was still in Palestine, and I was, you know, observing, I mean, you know, how the Netanyahu government, I mean, was really making things even more and more and more, you know, impossible. But Arafat, you know, you can see the reluctance in everything that Arafat was doing then. Nonetheless, he did it. But the greatest reluctance was, really, you know, in 2000, when he went to Camp David. He didn't want to go to Camp David. And as a matter of fact, he came out, you know, in public saying that it was the wrong thing to do. Of course, he didn't want to send the, you know, the wrong signal, I mean, from his point of view.
Hisham, I think he went further. As I remember, I was here in Washington watching these events, and each agreement worse than the other. And I knew, of course, the seductive powers of Clinton. He was the master of this. But I believe Arafat insisted. I remember diplomatic conversations, and I knew the diplomatic community pretty well then. Before Arafat would come to Camp David, he told Clinton, it's not prepared, nothing's going to come of it, this is not what we should be doing. Clinton kept insisting. And as I remember, Arafat insisted he would get in writing that if Camp David didn't succeed, which he expected would happen, that he, Arafat, and the Palestinians would not be blamed. He wasn't going to come without getting that. Is that how you remember it too?
No, absolutely. I was there, and I, indeed. But, you know, he didn't want to send the wrong signal to the world that he was not cooperating to achieve peace. And, you know, it's that symbolism, I believe, that has really hampered Palestinian work all along. Palestinians do focus a lot on symbolism and on trying to appear, you know, reasonable for the world. I mean, and often that comes really at the expense of hardcore, you know, political calculation.
Yes, but the Western world has psychology experts and has... The Western world has psyched out all of these Arab leaders and briefs the President and Secretary of State and all the negotiators, whereas the Arab diplomats, when they get a break in the proceedings, they don't go get briefings about what's going on. They go have tea and coffee and sit around and tell stories.
Absolutely. I think, you know, sadly enough, this is true. I have seen it. I have been witness to it, and, you know, no wonder why Palestinian diplomacy has been, you know, unable to achieve any concrete results.
Not just Palestinian diplomacy. Arafat was being manipulated not only by Clinton and the Americans, the Egyptians, the Saudis, the Jordanians, who rushed to make their peace treaty with Israel after the Oslo signing. They couldn't wait to sign on with the Israelis, and the Israelis couldn't wait to get the Jordanian peace deal signed. All of these regimes were manipulating Arafat, and they were doing it at the behest of the Americans and the Israelis.
Certainly, this is why Oslo was, you know, the most detrimental political blow to Palestinians after the Balfour Declaration. As you stated, look how short it took, really, for the Jordanians to follow with their own peace treaty with Israel. Look at the opening of markets the Israelis had in the Arab world immediately after the Oslo agreement with the Palestinians. I mean, the Israelis had a vision really for the region as a whole. To them, the Oslo agreement was a bridge, number one, to screw up Palestinian society, and for the lack of a better term. Secondly, to penetrate through the Arab world, if not fully politically, at least economically. So there were, multilateral talks, there were bilateral talks and what have you, over economic issues, over, water issues, over, and the Israelis succeeded impressively, I believe, in using the Oslo Agreement, number one, to solidify the occupation on the ground, to create more facts on the ground, so to speak, they like that term, and number two, to use the Oslo Agreement to pursue their interests in the Arab world more than ever before.
And then came, while all of this was happening, Clinton got himself reelected, then the Lewinsky scandal, then there was the impeachment, then there was the growing tension with Iraq, the rise of the neocons, the PNAC statement, the policy for the new American century, and when Netanyahu then came to the prime ministership after outmaneuvering Peres, there were efforts both in Israel and from what I call the neocons, who were largely Jewish American Zionists associated with a certain ideology here, and they immediately pressed on Netanyahu not just to water down and manipulate the Oslo process. They wanted the whole thing ended. They didn't even want the symbolism of a PA regime. They didn't even want the symbolism of Arafat calling himself Rais or President or whatever he did. I think they were still worried that the Americans, for their own reasons, and maybe the Europeans too, might somehow breathe some kind of life into the autonomy. That there was a period of time when I think the politicians were looking, how do we make it more than autonomy, more than what the Israelis have in mind, but less than sovereignty, even if we let them fly a flag and fly around the world and go to the UN. I think there was a lot of manipulation how to get to that point, but the neocons here pushed and the BB people pushed. And so you had nothing really happening except more settlements, more expansion, and more isolation of the PA in the last years of the Clinton administration. I mean, is that a reasonable summary, or do you see it a little differently?
Oh, no, absolutely, Mark. And there was another really great accomplishment, I think, that the Israelis, have achieved. And I did write about this, as a matter of fact. Then, to them, the idea of deploying so many Israeli soldiers in, heavily populated Palestinian cities and villages and refugee camps in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip during the Palestinian Intifada appears to be rather costly. I mean, costly financially, in terms of manpower, in terms of energy. I mean, costly in terms of the bad image that it has created really for Israel. I mean, here were heavily armed Israeli soldiers battling Palestinian children. So the Israelis were in desperate need to redeploy their army to the peripheries, to the edges, while at the same time they needed somebody to maintain basic, security and order in the populated Palestinian
area. To keep control of the Palestinians and keep them from rebelling and keep them from rising up again.
Absolutely. And in my view, the Israelis did view the Palestinian Authority exactly as the apparatus to achieve this security, matter. And over there, they have succeeded. And especially now, more than ever before, in using the Palestinian Authority to achieve Israeli security ends, and the Palestinian Authority has been more successful in that than the Israelis themselves.
And at the same time, the PA allowed more settlements were being built, more bypass roads, more apartheid. We didn't call things apartheid until after Oslo. Then we began using the word a little bit. It didn't really appear in public discourse until Carter's book, which must have been maybe 2005, 2006.
Right.
So all of this was happening. What turns out to have been in history a peace process was really a death process. Instead of movement toward a solution, it's taken us further away from a solution, and thus the title of our book, The Life and Death of the Two-State Solution. We're not talking about any longer something that can happen. We're saying it's already dead.
Well, just to end on a, you know, on an anecdote, Mark, you know, it is a peace process, but of course it depends on how one spells peace. I mean, it really is P-I-E-C-E rather than P-E-A-C-E. I remember very well in 96, I was at a conference in Ramallah, and I was giving a paper for Muwatan. Muwatan is a, it was like a research, you know, organization, NGO in Ramallah. And there were a lot of people as I was giving the paper, and I was talking about the performance of the Palestinian Authority and really what was lacking, you know, to establish a Palestinian state. And I do swear now that it was a slip of the tongue. When I said, rather than saying Sulta, which means authority, Palestinian Authority, I said Sila, which means commodity. So everybody was really laughing then, but then when I think about it, yes, really, this was more of a Palestinian commodity, you know, to be really used rather than a Palestinian authority to bring about, you know, justice and peace for the Palestinians.
And it led to the abortive Oslo, the abortive Camp David final attempt by Clinton, a final attempt to get Arafat further trapped, and I think they wanted him to sign some new documents and legitimize all that had happened, and he wouldn't do it. And then, of course, it led to the Second Intifada, but that's the subject for the next chapter.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Arafat, from his point of view, did everything he could. He was involved even in cracking down on Palestinians to try to satisfy the Americans and the Israelis and to demonstrate to them that he can be, you know, a head of a state. He went as far as abrogating the Palestinian National Charter, you know, when Clinton visited Gaza in the mid-90s. I mean, gathered, you know, some PNC members and some Palestinian officials, and in a ceremonial gathering, abrogated the Palestinian National Charter to satisfy Clinton's demands and, you know, other Israeli demands. So from Arafat's point of view, he did everything he could to bring about peace, but when he went to Camp David, I think he was absolutely fed up. And to him, this was an absolutely historic moment. Either he appears as a traitor for his people and sign on something that is less than a state, or he would stand his ground and appear as a nationalist who defended his people's rights, and of course he opted to choose the, you know, the latter. And he came back to Palestine. I was then there, and he was received as a hero. But of course, this was the beginning of his demise from the point of view of Mubarak, the Americans, and the Israelis. And immediately thereafter, of course, Sharon took over, and you know, Bush took over. What a combination!
And when they realized that they couldn't get Arafat, they couldn't squeeze anything more out of Arafat, when they realized that, they isolated him. They tried to bomb his muqtada in Ramallah. Eventually, they stealth assassinated him. But they squeezed as much as they could. And I think Arafat also, under the spell of Clinton especially, he wanted to be a client like the King of Jordan, the King of Saudi Arabia, the President of Egypt, Mubarak. He saw the Americans would take care of him if he would be their man.
Well, I think, you know, to put it differently, he always, you know, he wanted really to prove to Lebanon, and again, that's the symbolism, which is absolutely dangerous in Palestinian politics. He wanted really to show that he is capable of being, you know, head of a state, as, you know, the others were, but only to bring statehood to his people. When he realized that this was not attainable, then everything changed.
Yes, and fair enough. Over the years, you've always understood Arafat far better than I. I met him a few times, but could never figure him out, and his English wasn't exactly all that good. And I, you know, what did I see him, 3 or 4 times for, well, one evening, as you know, one evening we, Moon and I, had a long dinner with him at 3 in the morning. But I think you're right. I think all of this is right. He was trapped. He didn't know how to get out. He didn't want to be the sellout. He didn't want to go down in history as the traitor. But he did want, to be the first president of a real Palestine, and he wasn't willing just to take the title if, in fact, all the reality would have been drained from it.
Absolutely.
Well, that brings us to the next chapter, which deals with Sharon, the aftermath of the aborted Camp David, and a period in history that also brought us 9/11, which some people think of as, at least in part, blowback for all the policies the Americans had been pursuing for a generation. But let's leave that for the next chapter.
Absolutely.